Hey, everybody. Before we get started, I just wanted to give you a quick heads up here that my first feature documentary film is out on DVD December 6th. This is coming out, obviously, the next day. It's called Lords of Soaptown. It is a true story of a sport called freestyle walking and how it started out. Long story short, it started out as a prank, and there's a lot more to it, and the guys who created it are fascinating, interesting, wonderful guys, and I'm very proud of it. It took me 8 years to finish, and it's just finally coming out on DVD, which is actually, it's actually been more than 8 years since we started the film, but I'm very excited about it, very proud of it. It's a lot of fun. I'd really appreciate it if you went out and checked it out. And also, you're probably have noticed over the last few months, the sound of the show has gotten a lot better, and that's because Stand Up Records was kind enough to provide us with some equipment to help the show just sound better and help us compete with other, well, not compete, but, you know, help us kind of step up our game a little bit. And the episode you're about to hear with Derek Sheen is the first episode we recorded with his equipment, so I thought it was kind of appropriate to mention right now up front that that's why it sounds so good. But again, please, if you would, you know, check us out on iTunes and make sure you rate us and review us. It really helps us out. We're getting more and more viewers by the month, but, as you probably noticed, we don't have a whole lot of advertisers. So it really helps. That kind of thing helps, you know, get advertisers, get money into the show, keep it going. But thank you very much to Stand Up Records and Dan Schlissel at Stand Up Records for making this, the new sound possible. Thank you to Derek Sheen for coming on, and, thank you guys for checking out this episode. And if you would please go check out Lords of Soaptown on DVD again, bit.ly/SoaptownDVD. Thanks so much.
I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast.
The year is 1959. The album is Coral Records Presents Theodore. The artist is Brother Theodore, and my guest is Derek Sheen. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So this is easily the most surreal thing we have ever had on the show.
Oh, excellent, excellent.
It's mind-bendingly different than anything we've... I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard the show before, but, like, just we... Usually it's like, oh, yeah, I really liked Steve Martin. Cool. You know, and I love Steve Martin, but this is, like... I think I just told you. I was cleaning and listening to it at the same time. Not a good way to listen to it, so...
You really need to be... It needs to be headphones and isolated.
Yeah, some fire sign shit. Like, that's the same thing. That's why I never got into fire sign young. It took me years. Like, you have to actively listen. So where did you first hear of him?
I actually first heard of Brother Theodore, believe he was on a morning, not local, but definitely like an LA-based local morning show, because he was mounting a one-man show that he was touring between New York and Los Angeles.
Okay.
And they had the hardest time interviewing him. And I mean, he was in character for the most part. Mm-hmm. And so I was super intrigued because I think I was probably like 10 or 11 and I was a big horror movie fan. I was just starting to get into like The Residents and a lot more avant-garde stuff. I really tended to, that's kind of where my energy went. Mm-hmm. I just liked it. I liked, you know, Barnes and Barnes and, I wanted to look for him and there wasn't really anything available.
Mm-hmm.
So a few weeks later, he was on Letterman, and Letterman let him perform, and I was a fan ever since. So at that point, I started searching the library systems to see if there was any available copies, and at that time, you could send letters to libraries, and they would send exactly how I got, I got that record. I also got, like, photos of the Ed Gein's crime scene and anything you could get at the time just by writing a letter. So they sent me the album, and I recorded it onto cassette, because I knew I wouldn't have it forever, but it was amazing. I mean, it was just this sort of weirdly poetic, and it's before I, like, discovered Lord Byron and stuff as well, but this dark, visceral style of storytelling where, you know, he talks about the Holocaust, and he talks about the power of death, and...
Right.
And but there's a humor underneath of it, you know, that you realize that even, you know, in 1959, even not long after the Holocaust, and he was a survivor.
Yeah.
That he was able to do something that I really related to, which is finding the humor in places where it's not supposed to be.
Right.
And, you know, surviving things. And I think I really found sort of a kindred spirit in him as an artist. And I really glommed on to that style of, like, storytelling. Even as a kid, I found out, like, if you can make people laugh about horror, then it takes all the power of horror away from it.
Yeah.
Which is how you heal through it. And that was something he'd talked about later on numerous occasions about just the power of storytelling.
Yeah. I see, that's something I feel like I would love to listen to or watch after having listened to this. Because I will say, for everything I just said, there's just some great shit did definitely come mm-hmm. through. Oh my God, just hit. Hey everybody, guess what? New studio setup. I just hit a microphone with my hand like a fucking professional. Holy shit. Okay, so anyway, yeah, long story short, that's the kind of stuff that sort of came through, was like, I sort of assumed he might have been a Holocaust survivor. Based number one on the accent, and number two on the fact that, like, when he's giving these very, they sound like stump speeches, mm-hmm. some of the things, and it sounds like he's translating the sort of insanity of Hitler in terms of, like, just this powerfulness,
yeah,
into this, like, you know, absurd storytelling style that I've never heard anywhere before. And I feel like undeniably some of that has to be not just German, but, like, I grew up hearing this kind of crap.
Well, and his performances, his live performances, he would just be all in black, turtleneck, uh-huh. dark pants, and lit from underneath. So it's just one single light from underneath.
Yeah.
And it in a way, it sort of made sense because his the production style and his approach to the material always seemed like it really people needed to be isolated from any kind of color, any kind of brightness, the exits, everything needed to be focused on this one man who yeah. was full of rage and anger and unpredictable. But at the same time, there was a gentleness underneath everything that was underlying. And, you know, a guy who was angry at the horror of life, but at the same time still trying to reconcile it. And so it was very interesting, and it's still, to me, I think, one of the most polarizing performances that you can watch is something that's very, it's not about his body language, it's really about his face and his voice, and just being this isolated figure in a huge theater.
Yeah.
And not moving, you know, no set pieces, no video, nothing, just yeah. him.
That was the first thing to get over, listening to it, because I did not know what to expect. Because actually, here's the thing. So you suggested him. I look him up. And unfortunately, as I tend to do, like, up until the week before, I'm kind of just ignorant, which actually helps a little. It keeps it fresh, right? But I look and I'm like, I know that face. And then look at him, oh, yeah, okay, he's in The Burbs. He's in a bunch of things that I've seen. So clearly, I know this guy physically. But I don't know that I was even picturing that, because his voice is so, like, again, it's just so visceral,
mm-hmm.
even when he's being goofy, which is he does, like, quite often.
Yeah.
There's, like, not dad jokes, but, like, goofy, old-timey, very silly, weird jokes mixed in with, again, this very dark subject matter.
It's the spoonful of sugar.
Right, that's what I was going to... And is that the stuff, though? Is it just the little goofy things he throws in, or is there another piece of the humor that I might be missing, having only listened to it once?
Well, I think if you start to dig deep,
mm-hmm.
and even if you just even YouTube some of the performances yeah. or the pieces on things like food and culture, you see at first there, I think things hit on two levels. One, there's a very visceral type of rage where he just engages immediately. He's angry and he's confused, and that's where this starts to come from. And then as he starts to explain what he's talking about and starts to get into the minutiae of it, then you start watching him sort of reach for the humor in it. But the humor's it's not easy.
Right.
You know, it's very difficult, and he gives you little pieces of things to keep you listening. But he's really trying to give you information. But the type of information he's sharing, you can't just throw it at people without giving them a little bit of sugar here and there. Otherwise, right. you know, they're not going to want to swallow it. And I think his biggest power is in making people have to listen
yeah.
to find those nuggets.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't hand it to you on a silver platter. I mean, yeah, he'll give you, there were always little jokes in there here and there to sort of break up the overwhelming, you know, just apocalyptic darkness that he was talking about. But those were just little light moments, because underneath all the dark stories there was a lightness, but you have to mm-hmm. look for it.
It was interesting too, is listening to it. I like just based on the first piece in this, which is called Berenice, which is basically about falling in love with his cousin. At least it's a story about falling in love with one's cousin. That's the story. Like, first of all, my natural thought is to go to like Edgar Allan Poe, who, you know, while a creep, exactly, was also incredibly dark. And apparently he did a lot of readings of Poe. Like, that was one of the things he so it makes perfect sense that that was where his brain was. But also, he lived through this modern period that, like, we can't relate to. This sort of, like, it's not gothic, but I can see why the gothic would be attractive to him.
Well, I think that he, you know, was very, very young at that time, like, in his, I think, in his early teens. And so, watching the scope of human suffering at that age, and realizing just this sort of, you know, being in this turgid environment of just hatred and violence and still trying to not giving up on discovering yourself in this horrible place. And I think that that was, you know, some people left those places. And I mean, he was in Auschwitz. So some people leave those places with that imprinted on them forever, and they never can move away from the horror of it. So they just restart their life.
Sure.
We just, you know, you read about a lot of survivors who can reflect, but it's very careful when they do it. And more so than that, they restarted their lives and made believe that, it, you know, we're going to be, everything's going to be better.
Sure.
And I think when he got out, he was in that early, in his, you know, late teens, early 20s. So he already had that mindset of like, you know, he's rebelling, he's angry, he's hurt, and his family's gone. And how he worked through it is he channeled it all into talking about it. But he talked at people. His performance art was to talk at people. It wasn't a conversation as much as it was a monologue, and being able to talk about the horror of suffering at that level that nobody else could ever understand it,
right.
But you know, through the perspective of surviving it and how his mind reset itself and how life is incredibly precious. Even though it can also be incredibly fleeting and worthless to some people. And it's really about the futility of everything. But in a way, it's through the lens of a guy who really did want to live.
You know,
so,
that's a really good point. Just the idea of talking at people is, I think it's so critical. I think for all of us, like, anytime you go through any tragedy, there's that critical, like, listening doesn't mean bounce back. Listening means sit there and and listen. And I do. You make a very good point. Like the idea of a performance where that is a necessary part of it. Not just like, it's not the kind of thing where a heckler could come out. It's not stand up. He called it stand up tragedy, which, by the way, I love. That is beautiful. And also, one of the interesting things was reading was like his family's very wealthy, and I guess he had to give up his entire fortune for basically a mark. I think is what they gave him for it in exchange. Which is, again, money's not the most important part of this, but obviously he lost his family. And it's just all these things coming together. But that idea of getting through tragedy in your way, but being the one who is the sole voice of yourself. You don't have to have it bounce back. You don't have to have people relating to you. That's often the worst thing in the world.
You don't have to have thoughts and prayers.
Exactly. Yeah, 100%.
I don't think he wanted that, you know.
Exactly right. Yeah. And that's, God, that's a beautiful way to do it, is art. And that explains more why it's so off-putting at first, and not in a bad way. It was just like, oh God, what is going on?
But it really it opened up for me as a preteen who had I was already at a deep well for comedy. I mean, I was, you know, I didn't listen to music until I was in my late teens.
Wow,
I wasn't really even really exposed to it. It was all stand-up in our house. So
holy crap,
you know, I had that, and then the minute I heard that, I mean, I always wanted to do stand-up, but I just couldn't land on what my voice was. And I was a kid, so it didn't matter. It was going to change 100 times. But when the very first time that I really heard him perform, it's something locked into place, because I realized all this other stuff that I'm listening to, it's funny, but it's not, it doesn't hit me on a level.
By what we are, to the maggots in the cheese is the universe. To the worms in the corpse is the cosmos. How then can we be so cocksure about our world? Just because of our telescopes and microscopes and the splitting of the atom? Certainly not.
Science is but an organized system of ignorance. There are more things in heaven and on earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. What do we know about the beyond? Do we know what's behind the beyond? I'm afraid some of us hardly know what's beyond the behind. Creatures of twilight and illusion, we drift and drift toward our unknown ends. And that's why I feel the best thing is not to be born.
And we're Brother Theodore. I was like, you can do this. You can literally talk about these things. And it blew my mind. It actually just opened up this whole world for me where I was like, I can talk about the underside of things. It doesn't always have to be about, you know, things that make me happy, because that wasn't the thing that was fun for me to talk about anyways.
Sure, yeah.
I liked to talk about, you know, surviving abuse. I love to talk about, you know, I mean, just, I didn't have a great childhood. I had a great mom, but I didn't have anything else tethering me to, you know, I mean, I had an abusive stepfather. Mm-hmm. I had a terrible, you know, my real father was a nightmare. And there was just a lot of suffering. And yeah. So that was, when I saw that, I was like, well, that makes total sense. I mean, you can heal through these things by using humor, and I didn't realize that that was even possible.
Yeah.
That was available to me.
It's not, can I tell you, this is not the common story, and I love that somebody had, I hate that you had to go through it to get there, but thank you for giving me the story. So I'm saying is your whole life has led up to me having a good story to hear.
Which is great. I mean, it's part of the gig, right? I mean,
it's so fucking fascinating because it's always very similar to what mine is, which is like, well, I liked this. I liked this. It led to this. And like my mind got blown by one thing and I listened to a lot of other great shit and it was fun. And I wanted to be a goofy fuck off. And that's what I became. Right. So it took me years to realize what you got to realize so young, but you had to by necessity, in the same way he had to. Like, you had to, like, oh, good, I can glom onto this. This is a thing that can help me deal, and that's fucking fantastic. That's exactly what comedy ought to do, and it took me years to realize that.
Yeah.
I love that you had it so young.
I mean, you can still make jokes at the expense of the things that scare you.
Yes.
I mean, you have to learn how to do it, but right. But you can do that, and in a lot of ways, you build a bridge for people, because I don't think a lot of people know that comedy can do that.
Yeah.
I think they just are like, it's supposed to make me laugh, and then I feel better.
Right.
Sometimes everybody has stuff underneath the first few layers that's dark and painful. Everybody.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think the thing I got out of Brother Theodore was watching a guy who learned how to channel that
mm-hmm.
in a very healthy way, and then, like an ion cannon, just shoot it at an audience.
Yeah.
And it's like, now it's for you, now it's through my perspective, but now it's for you guys to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't laugh, then I don't give a shit. But if you do laugh, then that means you found that place that it's okay. It's okay. It's healthy.
Yeah.
I'm the one that's talking about it, so it's my experience. So it's healthy for you to laugh at it. It's okay.
Right.
That's why he was doing it. You know, there's a catharsis in that. You know, you can listen to audiences reacting to gasps, but then the people who are laughing are the ones that are like, okay, that's the best laughter. It's a release. You know?
Yeah. God. And it is that kind of like peeling away layers, like mm-hmm. Like you put it. It is, because it starts off. I don't know that any of the tracks on here necessarily compare to the others. They're all very different.
Yes.
Because you thematically could only put them together, again, just by saying, yeah, okay, he's got a dark perspective. Okay, fine. But, like, it does start off, again, if you're not paying attention, or if you don't know what to expect, which I think was more, I didn't know what the hell I was getting into, even after reading about him. And it starts off absurdist and very strange, and then it gets... voices start to come into it sometimes
mm-hmm.
and then I feel like the parts of it that become harshest are just when he gets so guttural, and that's the stuff that made me think of Hitler, and I'm like, this guy must have gone through the Holocaust, like, again, that's the first thing, and it's just so guttural and so intense that it's not, again, it's not something you would necessarily associate with stand-up.
Mm-mm.
But God damn,
and it's at a time, I mean, it sort of gets swept under the rug because it came out at a time where America was in a place of transition.
Sure.
We had just come out of the war.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, it was 1959. Baby boom is already in full effect. Mm-hmm. You know, you had 11 and 12 year old kids, and the nuclear family was really, I mean, it was a big deal. And I think people were trying to heal from that. And we were also on the cusp of, you know, our race politics sort of blowing up.
Sure.
And also on the cusp of, like, you know, I mean, you see a guy who's very young, and in transition, trying to find his voice, and sort of attacking this old way of doing things, but also in a time when there was still a sort of traditional approach to stand-up.
Yeah.
So you can see that battle starting to happen on the album, which is great, because he's still fighting against not having to just tell jokes.
Right.
But when you listen to a lot of the later stuff, when he's in his 50s and 60s, it's just, it's masterful.
Yeah.
Because he's taken, you know, what he did way back then. He still has that style, that approach, and building, and tension, and release. But there's a sorrow in him as an older man watching the world not getting any better. And it just gets, it was beautiful. I mean, a lot of his performances then were funny, but funny on such a different level, because he'd given up hope.
Yeah.
Hope had just escaped completely.
Yeah.
You know, by the late 80s, he was just nothing. Have we never learned anything?
Right.
And talking about the fast food industry and drugs and and elderly care, and just like, he was always that guy who wanted to talk about shit that nobody else wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
In front of an audience, and they didn't always want to hear it, but you had to find a way to deliver it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you need Jerry Seinfeld.
Sure.
Because you just want to laugh.
Sure.
And, you know, but everybody can relate to that, but who wants to just be talked at by someone you can just relate to?
Right, right.
And, you know, sometimes you want to go to a dark bar and you want to just drink shots until you're almost ready to pass out. I mean, that's how we heal sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Do you think, and this is probably a stupid question, just given how, to me, listening to this album, there's at least the artist part of him. I wouldn't say that there's an idealism underneath it, but there is, like, there's that kind of tenderness and that kind of sweetness that comes from a person who does just straight up want everybody to get along. Like, there is that underneath. And as you say, I'm now interested to hear in who he is later. Do you think that's just is that everybody? Or are there comedians who can be maybe even as dark as he is, but at the same time be, like, super idealist? Is there a combination of the two?
There can be. I mean, Carlin was like that.
See, that was kind of my first thought, yeah.
Carlin was, the great example of that, because he started as a very clean comic in the late 50s, and then got on TV and, you know, did Sullivan, you know, and was very, very TV clean, and did a lot of clubs, had a jazz drummer behind him all the time, and that was his gig, and wore a suit. And then he hated that. He hated it. He hated being that guy. And also, I think the counterculture revolution that was happening in the 60s, he had dosed, and then he started smoking pot, and then let his hair grow, and quit comedy for a year to figure out what he wanted to be. And then he came back and had a completely different style. The Renaissance, you know, at that time was like, you know, more, the stand-up was way more, like, you could say whatever you wanted to now.
Sure.
And so there was this great sort of golden age, second golden age of stand-up, where now you had these younger guys who were like, I can talk about stuff. Talk about sex. We can talk about the revolution, the cultural revolution. Talk about drugs. We can swear. We can say things. You know, we can be a little bit more blue. And he played with words, and he just had goofy jokes, and, you know, and he was kind of a weirdo. And then in the late 70s, he cut his hair, and his style changed again, because then he had kids, and his comedy became a little bit more focused on, you know, more real issues.
Yeah.
And then you watched him have a fourth age where, you know, when his wife died, his comedy became anger.
Yeah.
It became very pointed and direct, and he didn't have a sense of humor in it. I mean, he was still funny, but I mean, his sense of humor now had grown edges and corners, and he was angry and bitter and pissed off at the world, and his comedy was a direct result of, you know, watching, just realizing, like, well, nothing matters anymore,
right.
You know, it became less about politics and just more about humanity and the state of the world.
Mm-hmm.
The last show that he did, and I saw him warming up for his last HBO special.
Oh, really?
And he died like 2 months after he came to town. But and he was very, he was so nice to all the local comics. Like mm-hmm. we all wanted to meet him, and he was just super great. But his act had gotten to a place, and I was lucky because I'd gotten to see all four of these stages happening when they happened. And this last show was very much about, you know, fuck everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, it might as well have just been the title of the special because he was just, he was done reasoning.
Yeah.
And now he'd gotten to a point where he was officially just either like me or get out.
Yeah.
And I think that you can have that catharsis in your career where, I mean, it does. Your perspective changes. I mean, not every comic can do it with the same amount of respect for the art that Carlin had. So, I mean, mm-hmm. he still wrote amazing jokes. It's not like he gave up that part of him, but it's just his style changed. I don't see that with a lot of comics. I see them get older and they just get tired. You know, they don't get more pointed. I don't see Seinfeld coming out and doing anything but observational stuff still. And it's like, well, what else would you have to do? You're a multimillionaire.
Yeah.
I think once you stop... Once there's a reason to just stop, you know, writing jokes, I mean, what are you making fun of? Everything's great.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, a lot of comics just kind of, they coast. And there are a few guys that, you know, did great, but got older and got wiser and their style changed. But it's very rare.
Yeah.
I think with Brother Theodore, when he got older, it was all about the futility of life and mortality and facing the end of life and mm-hmm. and telling people, yelling at people to stop taking advantage of the moment and the beauty of things, or to stop taking advantage of great experiences like death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are all things that build character, and they're little building blocks that make you who you are.
Yeah.
And you can't just not face them. You have to face them, and they're great and they're terrible.
Yeah. It's such a stark perspective. And I guess you can hear it a little bit in this. Do you have out of the, it's technically three tracks, right? It's technically mm-hmm. three bits. Do you have a favorite of all of them?
I go back and forth. I mean, I've grown that album's so special to me, but I've probably grown to like the older, like the stuff he did later on.
Uh-huh.
Because you can really see that there's building blocks here. I love the story. I absolutely love the story of him falling in love with his cousin.
Uh-huh.
Because it's so bittersweet.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to pick a favorite track. I mean, they're all so unique, and they're, you know, they're not extensions of each other. So I think those things change, you know, the more you listen to it down the road. What was one thing that I really loved 10 years later, I like the other thing now. And I don't know. I never really had a solid favorite. I was a big fan of the whole piece.
Mm-hmm. Do any of them particularly resonate with you more in terms of like they've just affected you more in general or no?
No.
No? Okay.
No, I mean, it was really like the big picture for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't anything that I went back and like I listened to 100 times like I would like Steve Martin.
Mm-hmm.
It was something, and it's not unlike The Residents for me. I have the same affinity for Brother Theodore that I have for things like that avant-garde stuff that I really love, but or Snakefinger. You can only, it's once in a great while.
Yeah.
That I want to sit down and reapproach because it takes so much energy.
Because mm-hmm.
I don't want to just listen to one thing. You really need to listen to the whole thing, the piece. But it also puts you in a completely different headspace. And I don't always like going there.
Right.
Because I think that it affects me differently and it starts to poison the well of my stand-up. Which is why I don't listen to as much stand-up anymore either. Yeah. It's just, you know, I'd rather, I think the more I do that, the more I start to put it in there. There's already enough Brother Theodore, I think, in my approach to stand-up already that, and 70s avant-garde stuff that I, it's hard. It's just, it's not everyday listening. It's probably once every 5 or 6 years mm-hmm. when you have a wild hair and you have some extra pot and you just sit down and you go, okay, I'm going to get high and listen to this again and see what I get out of it.
Yeah.
You know,
that makes sense.
But it's exhausting.
You know, yeah, was it the same as a kid though? Was it more of an adventure as a kid?
When I was a kid, it was very much an adventure because it was a new thing and I was really turned on by it, but I also didn't overdo it.
Okay.
Because I understood the investment even as a kid. I was like, this is heavy shit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you can't just put it on your Walkman and ride your bike. Like I had to be in my room.
Mm-hmm.
homework had to be done. I had to be in my room with my headphones on, and I had to sit and force myself to listen to it.
Yeah.
Because there were so many nuances that I didn't want to, like, be distracted.
Yeah.
And when I was done with the album, I felt like I'd walked up 18 flights of stairs. Like, it was a big uphill climb to get there and be in the moment with that piece of art. And when you're done, you're like, whew, okay. You know, I mean, it's a workout. It's
yeah.
a workout on your spirit. And it leaves a little bit of an imprint every time that you're exposed to it. So, mm-hmm. you know, you don't want to do it too much.
I guarantee you've discovered him 10 years earlier than most people who probably love him as much as you do. There's no way that anybody, I won't say no way, but it's got to be rare that anybody's discovered him at that young age.
It was it was dumb luck.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you hear a band, you just hear a snippet of something, mm-hmm. and immediately you're a fan.
There is a disgusting abundance of stories with a happy ending. The time has come to reverse this trend. I'm going to tell you a tale too sad to be told. It happened long, long ago. Or to be more precise, 2 years after the discovery of dirt. Come with me now, my friends. Come with me to far-off India. The hot Indian sun beats down on the road to the blue pagoda. In the temple, the people sing and strew white blossoms for Buddha, and the priests pray, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om, Om. Whatever that may mean.
You're just like, that is me. That's me. That's the thing I want mm-hmm. in my mind right now. And so, but at the same time, you know, I had a lot more liberal upbringing in the sense that, like, as shitty as the vast majority of my childhood could be,
mm-hmm.
there was still this, you know, my mom still fed me art in any way that I wanted it. That was the payoff. Is like, yeah, I know this sucks. Okay. I know that we're stuck in this awful situation. If you want to watch horror movies and you want to make masks and that's what you want to do, then I'm going to feed you everything you need to be creative.
That's awesome.
And if you love comedy, then we're going to feed you comedy. Do you want to read books? Here's 100 books. So, you know, my room is like stacks of, you know, Robert Bloch and Poe and Lovecraft and Mencken. And King, early King, you know, I mean, and then I had horror movie posters everywhere, and then I had makeup everywhere, and I had comedy albums and books everywhere. So that whole part of my childhood was the only thing I could really fall into and escape from everything else. And so I had, you know, my mom was very liberal with the things that I was allowed to have as long as I respected what I was getting out of it.
Yeah.
And so Brother Theodore was like, you know, the minute I wanted it, it made sense in the collection of things that I was putting in my head at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on top of, like, the only time my mom ever stopped me was William Lustig's Maniac. Was the only time she was like, "We're not going to finish this movie.
Uh-huh.
We're 8 minutes in. The first time he kills a woman, she's like, uh-uh, we're not watching this.
All right.
We're not letting you have this. It's just, it's exploitative crap.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to have, you know, she was a mega feminist, so
yeah.
I was like, oh, okay, I didn't realize that was a thing, okay.
That's awesome.
So, yeah. Oh, so she was super good about letting me have that, you know, because the other things that we were getting at home were horrific, so,
mm-hmm.
you know, you needed to have an outlet, and both of us did, you know, hers was craft, and mine was, you know, trying to reconcile
yeah.
my surroundings with my art. So
yeah, I suppose with this different level of, I mean, again, not to say that other people don't go through the kind of stuff you went through, but this, it's great that you had also a different level of support. Like I always say, my parents were very supportive of my art, but hearing what you're hearing, like somebody gave you a library of the things you love and you got to pull from them and turn them into whatever the fuck you wanted.
Yeah.
I love too, though, that after all that, the thing you went to is stand-up comedy, though. That's interesting to me because not that I feel it, stand-up needs to be justified as an art, but I feel your experience justifies it more as an art maybe than the some stories I hear, and not on this show necessarily, but in other, I hear the same story is what I'm saying on a lot of other podcasts.
Yeah.
So it's kind of cool to hear a different story about how somebody came into stand up. Can you hear Brother Theodore's influence in you, in yourself, or is it not obvious?
I think if you were a fan, you could hear it. I think you could hear it more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I do tackle stuff that's important to me in a way that I think I'm not. It's not the, how do I put this? I was talking about this the other night, actually, and it's probably the best way to say it. I've been asked to do clean comedy,
mm-hmm.
which I have no problem with.
Mm-hmm.
I can do an hour of no swearing whatsoever. The problem is not those words. The problem is the content of the things I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I can do a clean set, no problem. But as long as you don't mind me talking about the visceral loss of suicide, serial killing,
mm-hmm.
Loss, death of a parent, surrealism, then we can do a clean set, no problem.
Yeah,
you know, and I like that. I like that approach, and I would say there's a lot more Brother Theodore in me than anything else, because I was emancipated from just having to tell jokes. You know, I could talk about my personal experience, but mm-hmm. also embellish it in a sort of Lovecraftian way. Example, like not just that my grandmother died, but like I imagine her sort of covering herself in a mucus membrane and just folding herself into a ball, and then the cocoon sort of hardens, and then mm-hmm. she erupts from it, and you know, with wings, and feeds on neighborhood animals. Like, it's my way of dealing with her passing.
I'm laughing, but I'm literally getting fucking goosebumps as you're describing it, and I want to walk out of the room. You're giving me the same fucking experience I got. Listen, okay, that's the only argument you needed to make. That is fucking it. And again, that's what I love about it. Like, that's not. What did your stand-up start out as, though? Were you ever a set-up punchline? Like, were you ever, like...
I tried, but I failed at it. Okay. I never really grasped this more simple joke writing. Like, the premise, the set-up, the premise, and the punch.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not good at that. Mm-hmm. What I was good at was sitting at a table with, you know, my friends and telling them, a story about my abuse.
Mm-hmm.
But making it funny, like
yeah.
giving, like bringing them in and listening to their jaws hit the table and then giving them the premise and then finding a way to get out of that so that everyone felt relieved at the end of the story or they laughed and I found a way to take power out of that memory.
Mm-hmm.
I loved that more than I liked, you know, short jokes. And so when I started stand up, I was having a hard time because, you know, I can't do 3 minutes of like, I can't get anything out in 3 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, there's an explicit amount of detail and language that I like to use, and so I was really learning how to do that, and I just couldn't. Short comedy shows and open mics, I failed at miserably, and it was a long time before I learned how to do that right, how to edit, but also at the same time be creative. And you know, the big thing for me is language. I mean, I always feel like those bits. Those pieces are like, they're all interlocking stacks. You can't do part of one thing. You have to sort of build it.
Mm-hmm.
And the words are important, and the timing is important, and the inflection. And it's like, I'm learning that all that stuff really goes into it. You know, I don't write my pieces down. I don't actually physically write them.
Sure, yeah.
I do them. I work on them as spoken pieces, and then I keep adding to them and seeing what feels most natural. And
mm-hmm.
then, you know, so it can take a year or 2 years to finish, you know, a 5-minute piece or a 7-minute piece, because I never feel like I'm done with it.
Right. No, I would imagine. And what's interesting, too, though, is when I hear people, and again, it's not uncommon, when I hear people talk about, like, I don't write it down, but I'm also like, I also love language. That's what blows me away, because I'm a writer and I don't do stand up, but I'm a writer. So it's so critical to me to be able to sit there, unless I'm improvising, in which case wing it, see what happens. But the idea that to love language that much, but also like, to leave it up to evolve. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's because word choice is so critical, but to find that word choice on stage when there's that pressure is weird to me. How do you handle that? Like,
You listen for what works and what feels most natural coming out of you, or what word you want to use, you know, and sometimes mm-hmm. I'll find myself in a place where I'll either be driving you know, for hours at a time, and I have time to sit and listen, and I'll hear something, and I'm like, that's what I should have used. Like, that word is better than this word, and it makes so much sense, and it also, you know, it draws a better comparison, or it creates a better picture, or it just, you know, or it sounds a little bit more toxic, and so I want those things to sort of work together, and, you know, I mean... It's not like all the jokes are. It's not like all the pieces are really dark. I mean, there's still a lot of levity.
We're being very heady about it.
There's still a lot of levity. But I mean, you know, I'm very. You know, I find that the way that I remember things mnemonically too, I like to have those. Drives me nuts when I see comics that are. They have a point of view and they have a picture they've drawn, but it's just so sloppy and lazy, and they don't use a lot of the. They don't use the words they could use to draw everything out.
Sure.
And, you're like, well, fucking just tell the joke right, you know? You wrote a great joke, just tell it right. Use your words, you know? That literally is you literally only have one job as a comedian.
Yeah.
And that is to use words to elicit a reaction from people.
Yeah.
That's it. So if you don't have those fucking tools, what are you doing?
Right.
You know?
Do you think that not enough, and this isn't meant to necessarily be, again, a judgment of any other comic, but not enough comics use their... They're concentrating so much on the structure that leads to a laugh or the structure that leads very pointedly to a joke that they're not concentrating on the emotive quality of it? Because clearly that's what you're doing, whether you're being dark or not.
Like, well, I mean, clearly... I gravitate more to those comics that get that, though, that know how to do that.
Yeah.
You know, that know, like, I mean, guys that I love to watch, besides Patton and Brian, you know, like, Dan St. Germain or Brian Cook or Heather Thompson, people that I love watching how they've those jokes are pieces.
Yeah.
And they're a solid piece. You can watch them do it every night and you don't get bored of the piece because you see how intricately designed it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's comedy's like a magic trick. So once you've revealed the prestige, it can get real boring.
Sure,
you know, because everyone's already seen you pull the rabbit out of the hat. But, but man, if it's an intricate design, then it's fun to watch all the pulleys and levers going into place every night because it's a piece of machinery, and that makes it more exciting for me.
Yeah, I mean, there are comics that I love and listen to who I feel like maybe, and this is. I keep, like, fucking excusing my opinions. But, like, Mitch Hedberg, it's like candy. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very... There's a reason it works. There's a reason so many people love Mitch Hedberg.
Mm-hmm.
And it is because it's easy to understand. It doesn't make it stupid, but it's very easy to understand. It's quick.
His jokes are so smart.
Yeah, and they are. They're brilliantly smart. But they're not emotive. They're emotive in that they're like, okay, got it, quit, wonderful. I get the joke. I get whether it's wordplay or whatever. And that it's just, I guess it's not something that comes up that often on this show, is like the reverse of that, which is building.
Yeah.
Building so much. That's a bigger risk, though, maybe. Am I wrong?
I think you're right. I mean, I think it is. It takes more of an investment from the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of audiences just expect the payoff to be huge, like fireworks every time.
Yeah.
But sometimes a good bit can be something that elicits a groan or a gasp or sheer horror because they laughed at something and then they feel bad for laughing at it. And you pushed them. It's not like you tricked them into laughing at something like, hey, that you guys all laughed at that joke. That means you're all racist. I mean, you know, you don't want to do that, but it's like to get them to laugh about like losing a child.
Right.
And then to put them there and go, okay, well, I mean, we all get that life is just a fleeting bunch of moments and circumstances. And if I know that you all want to have meaning attached to it. You have to. It's the only way your mind can cope with the absolute chaos of what's really happening around you that has zero meaning and no design. So if you can make them laugh at shit that they're not prepared to laugh at all the time and they don't have their defenses up, there's a real amazing catharsis in that and watching people go like, oh, wait a minute. Like, and when they look around and stop laughing, that's my favorite.
Yeah. I mean, it's very difficult. I mean, especially we live in America, we live in a country built on ideals and idealism and all this wonderful stuff. Like it's a challenge, and I think it's very artful if you can make people, at least for a second, contemplate the idea that there's no structure to anything, and we're all in this fucking boat together.
Well, look, I mean, when you watched Obama, or God, Michelle Obama, like 3 months ago, 2 months ago, when she was doing a graduation address, and it was brilliant because people were so absolutely gobsmacked that she had the fortitude to mention that they live in a house, the White House. She's like, we live in a house that is built on, built out of slave blood.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like she, like it's filled with the ghosts of dead slaves.
Wow.
And I mean, she did it to elicit a reaction from people that was very guttural. And at first people were like, oh, but then they had to reconcile that. Yeah, she's absolutely fucking right.
Yeah.
And I mean, in a way, that was a great piece of comedy.
Sure.
To me.
Yeah.
Because she delivered a stunningly bleak message about America's past.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of a, you know, what should be a celebratory address.
Yeah.
But she did it in such a way that it took people a second to realize that, oh, yeah, fuck, all of our ideals are backwards and mm-hmm. wrong, and it's mm-hmm. built on bullshit. And so, like, to me, that's a great introduction to how to deliver the goods, the news to people sometimes, but wrap it in something else, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
She, I mean, I love it because I think people get the whole notion of being offended by comedy is wonderful to me because it would, like, first off, who told you don't get to be offended?
Yeah.
And also, if you're offended, you're usually only offended because other people saw your reaction to it, mm-hmm. and it made you angry because you internalized it.
My friends, I'm here tonight to show you the way. I'm here tonight to share a great truth with you. I'm here tonight to dehypnotize you, to free you from a deadly collective obsession. I'm a voice for those who dare not speak. I'm a cry for hearts that suffer in silence. And I'm here tonight to tell you what needs to be told. I feel an itch for public service, and I've got to scratch it. In this best of all possible worlds, everything is in a hell of a mess. Everyone knows it. Everyone has a different explanation for it. But all of these explanations are bunk. Not money, or the lack of it, not the atom bomb, or the hydrogen bomb, or the cobalt bomb are responsible for our plight. Not capitalism or socialism, not militarism or pacifism, not cannibalism or ventriloquism. None of these are to blame. None of these are at fault. They are mere symptoms. They are mere manifestations of an evil that is deeper rooted.
That's usually where offense comes from. Mm-hmm. It's either that or you haven't reconciled your own personal, you haven't dealt with your own personal demons.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime anybody mentions and I'm going to put it in quotes, trigger word, mm-hmm. that's when you get upset. And
right.
It's like, well, that means you haven't, so you're just hiding your stuff?
Mm-hmm.
So you're not really offended, you're just scared you're going to have to face this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And comedy's, you know, it's become, I think, a really good tool for some people to learn how to cope with their social issues and justice. But at the same time, on another level, people are delivering comedy in a whole different way. They're not just giving people 20-second jokes.
Sure.
They're talking about stuff, and it, you know, I think it changes the fabric of the way people approach stuff, and mm-hmm. I hope that we can get to a place where you can laugh at a funeral, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
That and not just during the eulogy, you know?
Yeah. Do you think there's something to be said, not entirely in the opposite of what you said, but and I understand like the concern with trigger words, and I'm happy that you didn't say that people are trying to censor you when they're offended, because there are people who are like, oh, don't censor. Well, nobody's censoring you. This is not communist Russia. You're in good shape. Because I actually, in your case, I kind of understand where you're coming from. But that's, I also understand it because you're clearly a thoughtful comedian. And I do think people get offended less, and I could be wrong here, at somebody like you making a joke about a subject, as opposed to maybe a Daniel Tosh making a joke. Because I'm gonna go ahead and say he doesn't probably put a lot of thought into his comedy.
No.
I could be wrong. Okay. But I think he's a very, like, here's a ba-da-da-ba-da-da-ba. I didn't think this through. I went out of my way either to shock or just say a word that sounds funny to me or one that I know will elicit a reaction. But I feel like you can use that as an excuse, or then you can use that as an excuse.
Right.
Because, again, you put more thought into it. And if you go out of your way to elicit a reaction, I don't think you, meaning Derek, are going out of your way to elicit a reaction for the sake of it you have a further thought to get into it.
Right, right. I mean, I do have, I mean, there's a sensitivity to an empathy.
Sure.
That, I mean,
and I don't doubt that you have it.
You have to have it, and to be, I think, to do this, you have to, I mean, it's an ever-changing culture where people are a lot more alert.
Sure.
About things and a lot more aware about things.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it doesn't change the responsibility of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Or the stand-up, you know. So I see it in a way where it's like, I need to be, if I have a point of view, I need to make sure that I present it in the right way where there's, you know, no one's ever I'm the only victim,
mm-hmm.
you
mm-hmm.
know. And so it's a big approach, but people still get offended. Well, they get
sure.
offended in air quotes, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
They get offended and they'll tell you, you know, I was upset. I'm actually doing a bit about, and it's a true story. I was in Seattle, like, 6 months ago, and I got called out by someone after the show, and this is, again, it's a real thing, and I don't think people know where the limits of their progressivism
mm-hmm.
are coming from, or where they need to stop, or, but I did a bit about cannibalism, and it was just about, you know, going to Tokyo and finding a human meat bar, because you know that there's probably an underground... You know there's an underground dining club probably in Tokyo where you can eat human meat. And after the show, they came up and they were like, I just want to let you know that I liked most of the show, but I felt like I needed to address the cannibalism. As a paleontology student at the university, I really take great umbrage at you punching down at a marginalized and indigenous people. Cannibals are real people with real problems. And your white privilege disallows you from ever knowing what it's like to have to survive on human meat. And I was like, hold on a second. Did you literally just say that? So you're upset that I was talking about cannibalism. And also, fuck you. That's the most racist thing I've ever heard in my life. Like, they're not indigenous people. Like, I was talking about Tokyo and, you know, kind of a metaphor for Germany, like, at the same time. Like, they're not coming out of the jungle. Did you just did you just see the Green Mile or the fucking Green Inferno? Is that the only movie you've seen in the last 6 years? And
wow.
It was amazing.
That's the most articulate complaint I've ever heard, however wrong it might be.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
So backwards. But then I literally, the next night, I was doing the same show because I was working a week with a friend of mine, and I brought it up, and people literally were shaking their heads like, and no, that didn't happen. There's no way that happened. And I'm like, it did fucking happen. And people, progressives in the audience were just getting more inflamed because I felt like I was putting them on blast for like, this is, you know, I'm a progressive, but if we're going to play this game, then...
Yeah.
You all need to get your fam lit.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
You need to get your fam lit 100. And it was really interesting because, and then I talked about like, I talked that night about just like the concept of like, have we fixed everything? Have we fixed of your think pieces and your fake rage? Have they fixed everything? I mean, we still have a race, gender, and income inequality problem.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't fixed that.
Yeah.
So have you run out of voices for people to speak for? Have you run out of, have you just been like, okay, well, finally we did it, man. Like, race is finally solved. The issues of race and gender and hunger, we've solved it all with, you know, my outrage is finally, my internet and social media outrage has fixed everything. What's left? Oh, yeah, cannibals.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, first they came for the cannibals, and I said nothing, for I'm not a cannibal. So.
Holy shit.
Yeah, that's a real thing.
That is mind-bending. Wow. Do you own this album on vinyl?
Or do I don't.
You,
I'm
you
still looking for a copy of it. I'm still
how
looking for
hard,
it.
Like, do you know
it's
how,
very hard. You,
what does it run if you can find
eBay,
it?
eBay, I found copies for like 150, 175.
I mean, I guess it could be worse, but were they limited runs or just so highly sought after?
It was very limited. I'm pretty sure the label originally only made like probably a couple thousand copies
of
it.
Okay.
And, you know, and I'm sure they didn't all sell.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, at some point there was a record store that was like, we have this goofy spoken word album.
Yep.
And,
yep.
You know. It was in the bargain bin, and some dummy bought it,
mm-hmm.
or some hipster bought it in like the late 60s and was like, yeah, I guess I'll spin it, and then their head just exploded.
Right.
And
Are there any other spoken word artists that you've listened to after? I mean, he's an unusual case.
Oh, yeah,
case,
yeah. I mean, Lord Byron, again, another guy that I love. Like, mm-hmm. the sort of hipster aristocrat poet mm-hmm. that I love.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I would consider, really, Dick Gregory's, the album after the Kent State Massacre, I have that double album, where he was scheduled to perform at Kent State as a comedian.
Yeah.
And the day after the Kent State shootings, he was there and decided to still record his performance, but he did a double album basically laying the groundwork for what he was going to do next, which was just social awareness, social justice, talking about the government, and just getting these students in this, you know, at Kent State University to sort of counseling them.
Yeah.
And it was amazing because it's a beautiful album and angry. And, when you listen to it now, it still just makes you so pissed off that that we'd reached a fever pitch, you know, that at the time had nobody thought it was going to come to that, you know, although we're seeing it again all over again because history repeats itself whenever you just ignore all of the warning signs.
Yeah.
Can't happen here. Right. So to quote Frank Zappa. But, you know, it was beautiful. I loved the later Dick Gregory stuff, which to me isn't stand-up. It is all spoken word. And that was stuff I fell in love with as an early teen. And later on, you know, it was a big part of my record collection. I probably have a good collection of Dick Gregory and Mort Saul and, Wild Man Fisher for no reason, but who I wouldn't consider a spoken word artist, I would just consider him a performance artist.
Yeah,
but you know, it all sort of falls in that category for me.
That's interesting.
But not as much. There's not as much spoken word that I fell into, like Henry Rollins. There was one vinyl that I had of his, and then most of that stuff was on CD though.
Right.
But I had one vinyl spoken word album, and the same with. Oh God, there's one more that I know I have at home, and I'm trying to remember who it was, but I don't have as much. I mean, I think with Brother Theodore, it was really special for me, and it's still something I'd like to track down when I have the money.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because I would love to have it. I mean, I can steal it online.
Sure.
But that's not the same thing.
It really isn't. No, that's cool. God. Yeah. So if you're going to, again, I feel like you've made the argument, but if in a couple sentences you can put why people should listen to I almost said Lord Buckley.
Jesus. Or Lord Buckley, not Lord Byron. Why do I keep saying that?
Did you say Byron?
I said Lord Byron, and I was
it
like,
went right over.
That's so funny.
Right,
we're both thinking of Lord Buckley, but I kept calling him Lord Byron. You know, because what I really love is haughty 19th century poetry.
Oh my God! So
I love an aristocrat who,
you know, Buckley's son, if he's still around, is like here somewhere in the valley, and apparently looks exactly like him.
Holy shit.
I need to hunt him down.
Yeah, you need to. Oh God,
I've been
find
trying
him.
I've been doing my best like to hunt him down. Why listen to this album though?
I think you get, I mean, the reason to listen to the album is to listen to something that you haven't heard before in terms of your concept of stand-up and performance art. I think this would change that formula and probably change your DNA on some level for good, because you're listening to someone who suffered through, I think, one of the greatest atrocities of the 20th century and still managed to mine something from it that wasn't about pain, but was about growth, and still found a way to make it humorous, still found a way to talk about stuff on a level that most people still hadn't gotten their shit together by 1959.
Yeah.
You know, and we're still living in the dark. And here's a guy who found a way to talk about multiple subjects that had a very, very dark edge and found the humor in him. And if that guy can do it, then, and he can live to be 79 or 80 years old and live a full life where he had all these amazing moments and awakenings, then so can you.
Yeah.
And so I think, but once you're exposed to the fact that that's a real thing, that a person can do that, it also, whatever dumb thing that you've gone through, if it wasn't the Holocaust, then it fucking pales in comparison, so stop being a whiner, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's no, I mean, everyone's always got it worse than somebody else, and listening to somebody like Brother Theodore, even that first album, is, it's a great introduction to a type of, and an approach to an art form that was, it's still evolving to this point, and maybe it'll make you appreciate some other types of comedy that aren't necessarily just, you know, set up and punchline.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it'll wet your whistle or your appetite for something that's a little deeper or darker, or, you know, a little scarier, the challenges. There's nothing wrong with being challenged.
Yeah.
You know, stop reading King. Sometimes go read, you know, go read something. Go read some Heinlein. Mm-hmm. Doesn't always have to be King, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You want to read some fiction, read something that gives you something back sometimes.
Right. And I will point out, like in this case, normally I will point people to, please go buy it on vinyl. But sure, if you can afford it, go right the fuck ahead. But you can find it on YouTube, and I think you're excused.
Yeah, I think you're, yeah.
I don't know when this episode is going to come out unless you have something urgent to promote.
Nope,
if you do,
nope.
Okay, well, let's say several weeks down the line. Either way, where can people find you? What might be coming up in the near future for you?
If you want to find me, although my website right now is great. I have not updated the dates in a little while because I've been in Los Angeles for a month.
Uh-huh.
So almost all of my dates have expired. I have a tour coming up. It starts in New York on August 26th. And I think that calendar is actually on my website at derektime.com.
Mm-hmm.
I won't get home until like November, but I'll be on tour for most of the fall through the East Coast. And then late September, October down the West Coast. And you can catch me in Arizona, and you can catch me in Boise and Albuquerque, and then I'm hopefully by October, November, my Tiny Idiot, which is on Stand Up Records, will now be officially on vinyl at that time.
Ooh.
So it will, the new vinyl will come out.
Awesome.
We're doing a 500 pressing, and it's all going to be limited colors and editions, so we're doing like 100 of each.
Oh, nice.
Like different variants, which will be fun. And then that album came out May 4th, which turned out great. I mean, I'm happy with it, but the third album is already in the can. So
Shit.
It's already mixed and mastered, and we've just been sitting on it until people get tired of Tiny Idiot, which has probably already happened. After the first listen, everybody's tired. But that one is going to be called Baby Dick, and that is coming out probably, if it comes out by the end of the year, I would be very stoked, because that would mean that we have two full albums out in a year.
That's crazy.
And Dan is buying my first album from the other label right now, so we will re-release that and remix it and probably recut it a little bit.
Okay.
And do a new edition of Holy Drivel, and that'll come out. So it's going to be a fun year. I mean,
that's,
I just hope that, you know, at some point I can be here in Los Angeles and not in Seattle, which is, I would love to get off the 40 milligrams of citalopram that I'm on and move to a place with constant sunshine where I'm losing weight on my ramen diet. It's amazing.
Well, this has been a fucking blast. Thank you so much.
Oh, dude, thanks so much for having me out. I